Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Mark Sosinski to discuss his recent oral presentation at the ASCO meeting on the use of nab-paclitaxel in non-small cell lung cancer. But first, I asked Dr. Sosinski to take a step back and comment on a corner of this disease where there's great controversy and maybe a lack of definitive data, the management of stage 3 disease.
I think stage 3, you know, after a fair amount of excitement about integrating chemotherapy with radiation and then kind of evolving into the concurrent approach and buying into that, and there's kind of been a lull in the enthusiasm here because we've kind of reached a plateau, if you will. In the U.S., I think most physicians have bought into the concept that concurrent chemo is the standard of care. I think the controversies there are the nature of the concurrent chemo. We have two national standards. We have the SWOG approach, which is the cisatoposide in full doses, and we have the, I refer to as the CLGB-RTOG approach, which is the low-dose weekly carbotaxol approach. They've never been directly compared. If you look at surveys of what oncologists do, it's about almost 50-50 when you come right down to it. We haven't adequately explored the role of induction versus consolidation. One of the things that if you buy into the concurrent concept, you can only, in the 6 to 7 weeks of radiation, you can only administer 2 cycles of chemo in 6 weeks. You know, we give 4 cycles in stage 4. We give 4 cycles in the adjuvant setting. Why do we give 2 in the stage 3 setting? If you're developing a level 1 evidence-based guideline, the trials that have been done really support the use of just 2 cycles during radiation and nothing else. We've had several trials that have looked at induction, several trials that have looked at consolidation. Those trials have been, quote unquote, negative trials. But in the design of those trials, they look for a pretty big difference. And we know that the difference on the tail of the curve may not be significant. Let's face it. We give adjuvant chemotherapy for a 5% benefit at 5 years. We have not done a trial in locally advanced disease that rules out that either induction or consolidation might not give you that small advantage that we accept in the adjuvant setting.
And, you know, with the caveat of trying to make intertumor comparisons, you think about breast cancer in stage 3 or locally advanced disease, nobody even thinks about it. It's, you know, as you say, it's in between metastatic and adjuvant.
Right.
So we'll talk about clinical research approaches to improving things, but how do you yourself approach it outside a protocol setting, particularly with this issue of induction and consolidation?
Right. So the first thing is adequate staging. You can't rely on CT scans and PET scans. You have to have pathologic documentation of the stage, whether it's 3A or 3B. It may make a difference in your radiation plan and that sort of thing, but I've always made the argument that we would never make a recommendation in a breast cancer patient without knowing the pathologic status of the regional lymph nodes. We ought to know the pathologic status. There are a lot of false positives, false negative with PET scans, and so we need to do adequate staging. And that's the first point.
So in a younger, healthier patient, how do you actually approach that specifically?
Yeah, I think now we have lots of options. Depending upon what your CT shows, that gives you a roadmap. Sometimes it's EBUS, sometimes it's EUS, sometimes it's cervical med, sometimes it's a Chamberlain procedure. Really, you have to tailor it to what the CT looks like. The PET scan can be helpful in guiding where you go to document these nodes. But we have, you know, our surgeons and pulmonologists have all these techniques that they can get you tissue from these sites of suspicious disease.
You think patients are better off, I mean, I know this is kind of a controversial issue, with a surgeon who's involved with these patients who specifically focus on some thoracic oncology as opposed to a general thoracic surgeon?
I think so. I think that if you're a dedicated thoracic surgeon, you tend to know the literature better. You tend to know the techniques better. You tend to be a bit more aggressive and understand the importance of staging. And so I think patients are approached in a more systematic manner.
Do you think the morbidity from procedures is lower?
Well, I don't know that. I can't quote any comparative studies. But, you know, as I say to my patients, if you need your brakes fixed, you'd like to go to a guy that does brakes full time. I can't help but think if you're doing 3 or 4 mediastinoscopies a week, that the complication rate in that surgeon's hands is if you're doing 3 to 4 a year.
So you stage the patient, then
right.
How do you think
if you confirm that they have mediastinal disease,
right,
then most of those patients at our institution are managed non-surgically. We can talk about the role of surgery in a bit. But really, if you document mediastinal disease, particularly if they have bulky mediastinal disease, I think the standard of care is chemotherapy with radiation. Again, we talked a little bit about concurrent. I think that's the appropriate part. At our institution, our trials as well as off trial, we have historically done induction therapy for two cycles. And then we at our institution have been rather aggressive from a radiotherapy point of view in the sense that 15 years ago, we started to do dose escalation studies and started at 60 gray and have gone up to 74 gray using three-dimensional treatment planning, all that kind of stuff. And I think the one thing we've proven is that you can certainly give a higher dose safely. And so the standard dose at our institution now tends to be 74 gray. And again, even though we've demonstrated that you can do it safely, we don't know that it necessarily leads to better outcomes. Our outcomes, which we've published, have been quite good. Median survival is typically 2 years. 5-year survival is about 26-27% or so. So we think we cure about 1 in 4 of these patients. So it's not too different than limited stage small cell in our institution.
So just in terms of particularly the older patient,
right.
Let's say you have a patient in their 70s,
right.
Pretty good condition, not any major COPD or smoking-related issues, but who says, okay, well, I'm about to get chemo radiation, and you'll talk about the regimen. What's the chance I'm going to cruise through this? No problem.
Right.
What's the chance I'm going to go through it? I'm going to have some problems. It's not going to be a big deal. And what's the chance I'm going to have a major problem?
Yeah. So the major issues you see typically with this approach, I mean, the one that's the most difficult management issue is esophagitis. And I think that over the years, we have developed a very prospective approach to esophagitis. We tell patients you're going to get some degree of esophagitis in our studies using prospective management in trying to minimize the length of esophagus that gets the dose of radiotherapy. Our rates of severe grade 3 to 4 esophagitis is about 10% taking all our studies.
So with the tube?
No, that's just basically requiring frequent IV hydration, pain medications, perhaps some nutritional support and those sorts of things. Only rarely have we had to put a tube in, actually.
And what's the usual duration that's been observed?
Yeah, typically, you know, if we're doing 7.5 weeks of radiation, it gets severe around week 4 or 5. With our chemoradiotherapy, it usually is clearly improving within 10 to 14 days of completing radiotherapy. And once patients can get over that hump, they tend to do okay following that.
Any supportive care measures that make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, we think, although we don't have prospective data about this, we think that there are a couple of tricks that we've learned over the years. One is obviously hydration. These patients are coming to radiation suite every day. We see them once a week for chemotherapy. You can give them all the hydration you need. Secondly, we work with a nutritionist. She talks to them about food supplements and stuff like that and nutritional supplements, and that's important. It makes patients feel better. We put almost everyone on a proton pump inhibitor because we think during chemo rads there's a fair amount of reflux. We have typically used weekly carboplatinum Taxol. With that comes weekly steroids. We have seen a number of fungal infections. So we almost routinely put people on antifungal therapy prospectively before they start to develop symptoms.
Which one?
Diflucan. And we'll keep them on that during the course of the radiation. In fact, we've written into a couple of our protocols that you would routinely start a proton pump inhibitor in Diflucan 2 weeks into your therapy, regardless of whether or not you're having symptoms. So sort of prophylactic measurements. Aggressive pain medication. And a lot of it is cheerleading. A lot of it is saying, you're going to get this. It might be severe. But remember, we're doing this to try to cure you. And there is a point A and a point B. If it develops, it does go away. Our rates of esophageal stricture are about 5% or less. We have a few patients that will require, you know, kind of chronic dilatation. It's unusual to do that. Your degree of acute esophagitis doesn't necessarily predict that you'll have problems with stricture. So my feeling, if you have a problem with the stricture, that's a victory because you've likely been cured of your disease. And if you're worrying about this 3 to 5 years later, I mean, your stage 3 lung cancer. I had a patient that I treated 8 to 8.5 years ago who had had 3 dilatations, and I saw him about a month ago. Wonderful guy, came to us with 3B disease, and we treated him with chemo rads. And he said, you know, I think I'm going to have to go back and get my esophagus stretched again. I said, well, to me, that's good news because you're 8.5 years out, and certainly he hadn't lost any weight or anything, but I think he was just feeling a little bit more uncomfortable with swallowing.
And just to kind of reflect back on the question I asked you about surgeons, what about radiation oncologists? You know, we kind of hear prostate cancer, a lot of other diseases where radiation and IMRT, et cetera, conformal radiation is utilized, that pretty good quality is occurring in the community. Again, I think you kind of get the same thing in a community as a tertiary center from Radonx in this situation.
I think it's getting better. Historically, you know, if you look back 20 or 30 years ago when radiotherapy was the standard of care, the five-year survival rate was less than 5%. It was mostly deemed palliative treatment. I think physicians were relatively conservative and had the sense of, you know, some degree of nihilism about the goals of therapy. I think with the advent of the technology and the advent of, I've been fortunate at UNC to work with a great bunch of radiation oncologists who are aggressive and forward-thinking and have really utilized the technology to kind of enhance tumor targeting, minimize normal tissues that are in the field. And I think it's a real therapeutic advantage for patients.
Now, you mentioned the induction and concurrent therapy. What about consolidation?
Yeah, you know, I think that, as I mentioned before, during the concurrent part, you can only really get in two cycles of therapy. And I think that we have historically done induction because we think it's better tolerated. If you go through radiotherapy for 7 weeks, there's a fatigue. If you got bad esophagitis, the last thing you want to do is get two cycles of chemotherapy following. So I think if you kind of think in the four-cycle mentality, whether you give your two cycles up front or out back, I can't argue one way or the other. Our experience has been that induction is better tolerated. Consolidation, you run the risk of not being able to get it in because if you have a bad esophagitis, patients kind of say uncle and they don't want to do it and time elapses and stuff like that. I think a consolidation strategy is very reasonable. In fact, the phase 3 trial that's ongoing and run by RTOGC, LGB, and NCCTG gives concurrent carbo-taxol with radiotherapy. There are two arms comparing 60 gray with 74 gray, and then it's followed by two cycles of carboplatinum taxol at full doses. So it does give consolidation therapy. So I think it's a reasonable strategy. I do always get concerned about the delivery of that versus doing it as an induction.
Do we have any data right now in terms of in that study? And of course, the other thing in that study I want to ask you about is the use of cetuximab.
Right.
But do we know anything right now about what fraction of people actually get both cycles of consolidation?
No, I don't know. The trial is accruing relatively well. The goal is, I think, 510 patients or so. I don't know the exact number, but the last quote I heard, I was a bit more optimistic than I thought we were going to be in this trial. But so it's going along. I don't think we have any data yet about the consolidation aspect of it.
I mean, what you're saying makes complete sense. I mean, logically, so really you're given the induction as kind of adjuvant or, you know, for adjuvant purposes.
Right.
I mean, is there any thought, too, that maybe shrinking the tumor in any way would impact the effect of the chemo radiation?
Yeah, we actually looked at our series of patients. And the nice thing about this three-dimensional treatment planning is you can get tumor volume numbers. And we actually published a paper a couple years ago looking at predictors of survival. And the one thing that came out as a predictor of survival was the tumor volume post-induction therapy. So you have your volume at baseline, volume after two cycles, and it was the volume of when you started radiotherapy. Now, to me, that made sense because, you know, if you're giving a given dose of radiotherapy, it's going to control a smaller volume better than a larger volume. So, and our radiation oncologists seem to like it because they do like this idea of the volumetric reduction. They can kind of cut their fields a little bit and have less toxicity.
Now, where are we right now globally in terms of research in this situation? Obviously, you know, this trial reflects the fact that at least one agent, a targeted agent, cetuximab, is being looked at. Before we get into that, globally, where are we? What are some of the questions that people are thinking of asking in addition to these two that this study is?
Yeah, I think there's questions about optimal chemotherapy to give with radiotherapy. I'm not quite sure there's a lot of enthusiasm for doing studies that continue to explore the role of induction or consolidation. And I don't know that we'll ever have a definitive study, and I think we'll argue about it for years to come because, you know, we do have a couple of studies of induction therapy, one done by the CLGB and one done by a Korean group that were negative for induction. We have the famous HOG study of consolidation docetaxel that was a negative study. You know, it's a very small study. So, you know, I think that
is that your take on that? Because, you know, I think of all the studies, that HOG study is the one that turned people off the most to consolidation. Do you think that was large enough to be your previous point?
It was a small study. And remember, when that study was designed, it was designed to look at the difference between the two SWOG studies that had been previously published.
Right.
SWOG 9019 had a median survival of 15 months, and SWOG 9504 had a median survival of 26 months. So it was looking for a large difference in median survival. And I always felt that that was too large of a difference to see. We like to see differences in median survival of 2 or 3, maybe 4 months. That would be great. You can't ask a year's difference in median survival. So it was underpowered. Now, having said that, the survival curves, there's no hint of a benefit. Now, we have to be aware that when we say 4 cycles, we are typically talking of 4 cycles of a platinum-based doublet. This was giving a doublet for 2 cycles and then going to a single agent. So, you know, I'm not quite sure that that is completely reflective of how I think about this disease in terms of 4 cycles of platinum-based therapy.
What about the issue of targeted therapy? And we'll talk about EGFR antibodies, but also I'm curious about the issue of EGFR TKIs, or erlotinib, gefitinib, in view of the data that's come out over the last year or two from the IPAS study, et cetera, right, on EGFR mutations.
Right.
You know, we had that study, I think it was SWOG, that looked at, was it erlotinib?
Gefitinib.
Gefitinib, yeah, in the stage 3 setting that was, yeah, either negative or
it was,
really negative.
It was alarmingly, yeah, inferior for
But
gefitinib.
Of course, they weren't selected no. for, you know, EGFR mutations.
Right.
Right now, I mean, if you have a patient with locally advanced disease who's a non-smoker who's got an EGFR mutation, would you consider integrating that into the treatment?
Well, yeah, and I think it's a very pertinent question to the adjuvant setting. If you have
Absolutely.
A resected patient and you have an EGFR mutation, what do you do? We have a trial out there called the RADIANT trial that will give us some information about this, but I don't know when that data will be available. You know, I must say, I have been very impressed with the IPAS data. I've been impressed with all the data using a TKI in patients who have that molecular abnormality. We're going to present some data at this meeting, a CLGB trial that looks at a North American CLGB experience in never smokers. And I think the lesson of that trial is that it's going to basically reinforce the IPAS paradigm, if you will, that it's all genotypically driven.
Now, do you have patients there with mutations who got the TKI before chemo?
That trial was either you got TKI alone or TKI
right.
with chemo.
Right.
So those are the two comparisons.
So did you get an additional benefit with the chemo?
You know, the trial had 188 patients. My take
That's
home.
Small.
Yeah, it was a randomized phase 2.
Okay.
It was not a phase 3.
Right.
And so you're kind of looking for hypotheses with this trial. My take home message is that I think if you have an EGFR mutation, erlotinib is a very good drug. And I'm not quite sure from this data, although you can look at the data a couple different ways, that there's necessarily a benefit to doing combination chemo TKI. I think you might get as great a result with sequential. You know, give a TKI. If patients can be on a TKI for a median of a year or so, and I've personally had patients on for 3-4 years with a mutation, and then give them chemo, I'm not quite sure that that wouldn't be a reasonable strategy.
So does that mean that you're going to offer a TKI to a patient in the adjuvant or stage 3
right.
setting?
Yeah, so we're back to that question. If I knew a patient had an EGFR mutation, I must say the impact of therapy in that population is great. This is a curative setting. I would seriously have a discussion with the patient about these issues. We don't have data. It would be hard to do. There are issues of cost in coverage of these sorts of things. If I had a young patient in the adjuvant setting or the stage 3 setting that I knew had an EGFR mutation, I would have a serious discussion with them about the potential benefit in the absence of data of taking a year or two of a drug like erlotinib.
How about in the post-chemo radiation or stage 3 patient?
Right. I would have the same argument. Now, there, of course, we have to deal with the SWOG data you mentioned, that gefitinib had a negative survival advantage compared to placebo. But that observation remains an enigma. I don't think anyone has a good explanation for it. We all cite it. We all wonder about it. But there's no biologic reason that if you have an EGFR mutation in everything we know in stage 4 disease, that these drugs should be detrimental to patients in that setting. So there had to be some other issue in that population that accounted for that finding.
So what about EGFR antibodies, specifically cetuximab? Obviously, it prompted this huge cooperative study to look at it.
Yeah, the RTOG had done a single-arm phase 2 trial, and their outcomes were actually quite good there, so that got integrated into the phase 3. The one kind of fly in the ointment was the CLGB trial that Govindan presented a year ago. And, you know, we designed a trial in which there were kind of two objectives. One is to look at the role of full-dose carboplatin in pemetrexed with radiotherapy. And so we did 4 cycles of carbo-pem with, I think the dose of radiotherapy was 70 gray. And then it was a randomized phase phase two that the other arm added cetuximab to that paradigm. And the trial was designed in such a way that we were interested in either arm if the median survival exceeded 18 months. The median survival was 22 months on both arms. The cetuximab arm did not have a better survival experience. In fact, it was slightly worse. So, you know, I'm a member of CLGB. I have to be honest with, you know, if we were sitting at an advisory board and we saw the results of this trial and you asked the members of the advisory panel to say, well, would you go to phase three based upon this data? I think the overwhelming answer would probably be no. There was no real signal from that trial that cetuximab made a difference. Now, it wasn't designed to really be a good comparative trial, but I don't know. I think we are investing a lot of patient resources in this phase three. It's based upon a single-arm RTOG trial. It's based upon extrapolations from the head and neck experience and that sort of thing.
That I think really got people excited was the head and neck.
Exactly. And so I think it's worth testing. I do think anti-EGFR therapy has a role in lung cancer, whether it be TKIs or the antibodies. The question is going to be patient selection.
Anything in terms of tissue assays that looks promising, including in the metastatic setting?
Yeah, that's been the disappointment. You know, obviously the success of identifying the EGFR mutation and the sensitivity to a TKI, that success has not been realized with the antibodies. I think it's, you know, obviously in colorectal cancer, we understand the role of KRAS. And I think in lung, it's been disappointing. We do not yet have evidence after interrogating kind of immunohistochemistry, FISH testing, KRAS mutation status. We don't have a good biomarker. The one caveat is the trials that have addressed this have not had 100% of patients with tissue available. It's been 25 to 30% of the samples. Not all of them are usable. So, you know, it's still very foggy and very cloudy. I've always felt that a drug like cetuximab is going to be difficult to use in lung cancer till we find a biomarker. And, you know, I mean, I hate to use the analogy of breast cancer, but, you know, if you used Herceptin in an unselected breast cancer population, it probably wouldn't look as good as cetuximab.
It doesn't.
So the point is this is a great drug in breast cancer, but you got to enrich the population. And hopefully the Southwest Oncology Group is doing a large trial in which biomarkers are an important part of that trial, and it involves cetuximab. So I'm hoping that with better tissue selection or patient selection based upon tissue, that will have an advantage.
What about cetuximab off study right now? I guess, has it been 2 years since the FLEX study was presented?
Yeah.
And what about in the concurrent setting off study? Are you using it in either of those situations?
In the metastatic setting, you know, it's a consideration to me in the squamous population in which, you know, you really don't have the option of a drug like bevacizumab. If you have a patient who's on the younger side, the patient understands that they don't have curable disease, they have treatable disease, they want to be more aggressive. The FLEX study is a positive trial, and we can't ignore that. We can argue about the magnitude of the positivity, and we can argue about the Caucasian analysis. To me, the Caucasian analysis of FLEX, the benefit in that setting is identical to the benefit we get from bevacizumab shown in ECOG 4599.
What analysis? This
was a pre-planned analysis of FLEX. FLEX had, I forget the exact number of patients, like 1,150 patients. They had a pre-planned analysis based upon ethnicity. If you remember the intent to treat analysis, the hazard ratio was 0.87, and the p-value was 0.04, and the difference in median survival was about a month or so, 1.2 months, and the difference in one-year survival was 5%. If you look at just the Caucasians, now, the Caucasians were 950 patients or so. So it's 100 patients larger than ECOG 4599. But if you look just at Caucasians, the hazard ratio was 0.803. The p-value was 0.003. And the difference in one-year survival was 8%. And that's identical to the ECOG 4599 result. My point being that this antibody has potential utility that's roughly identical to bevacizumab in most of the patients we see in the United States. So that's why I think these drugs have utility in lung cancer. Now, do I think that you should be trying to make a decision between Bev or cetuximab? No, I think Bev is the standard of care in non-squamous. But in the squamous patient, where you're obviously not going to use Bev, We have used it sometimes. We in North Carolina have the hypersensitivity issue right. that we have to deal with. So yeah. it's a
Rich
decision.
Rich Goldberg talks about that all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah, we've used it in some metastatic setting. Now, outside the metastatic setting, off protocol, I would not use it with radiotherapy. And certainly we've not entertained it in the adjuvant setting since there is no data.
That's a really interesting point. That remind me of the racial background in the FLEX study. When you say Caucasian, who were the non-Caucasians?
Well, in that analysis, mostly they took out the Asian population.
Right.
I think it was it was 12% Asian
right.
population.
Okay.
So,
yeah, now it's
so in the Asians were principally female never smokers. Mm. So with adeno in a good performance status.
Interesting.
So it was an interesting observation.
So we're getting ready to do an entire education program just on dermatologic toxicities of oncologic agents, and of course Mario Lacouture is
yeah.
working with us and a couple other people. But, Mario has shown, and, you're starting to see this subculture of dermatologists who are interested mm-hmm. in this, an impact on really preventive approaches to dermatologic toxicity. How do you approach it preventively and treatment-wise, and what have you seen?
I think Mario has done a great job in getting oncologists to kind of think about the dermatologic issues, and it's been very helpful. Most of us were not very good dermatologists when we started this, and we're getting better. And I think the companies that make these EGFR inhibitors have been helpful in kind of developing some kind of algorithm that we use, and we've all got published ones. We pretty much do that. Different patients have different levels of concern about the rash. We have some that will say, well, if it happens, we'll deal with it. We have some that say, I don't want it to happen, and so we're more prospective with them. We follow the same sorts of paradigms that everyone else has done. And so I think that that's been a very helpful effort, I think, for the practicing oncologist.
So do you, I think it's called the STEP regimen, or I guess I got to learn that stuff. But I know one of the things they'd use is, again, for the patient who wants to do something preemptively, antibiotics and creams and
right.
stuff, you
yeah.
do that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what we do. And I don't know that we have kind of the same thing in every patient, but it involves the ointments and creams. And then prospective minocycline we typically use.
So how about the data you're presenting here at ASCO? You were talking about carbotaxol in the concurrent chemoradiation setting, but now we have this whole issue of NAB,
right.
paclitaxel, which you've been working on for a while. It's
right.
been around in breast cancer. What's
right.
coming out?
Yeah, so at ASCO, we'll present the phase 3 data. We had done a phase 2 trial, kind of a 7-arm phase 2 trial that was really a dose and schedule to try to identify a dose and schedule of NAB, paclitaxel, and carbo that you would put up against carbotaxol in a phase 3. And that came out to be a regimen of carbo AUC of 6 every 3 weeks and 100 milligrams per meter squared of NAB, paclitaxel weekly with no breaks. So day 1, 8, 15 every 21 days. And so the phase 3 design was carbotaxol, AUC of 6 and 200 of taxol every 3 weeks versus the same dose of carbo versus weekly Abraxane at 100 milligrams per meter squared. Now, remember, Abraxane is reformulated paclitaxel. I happen to think that it's a biologically more potent formulation when you bind it to albumin. I think we're beginning to understand that there's this process of transcytosis that's mediated through caveolin 1.
Hold on, transcytosis?
Transcytosis,
what's that?
Yeah. Actually, if you, and this has been actually very nicely worked out in a number of different laboratories, it's basically the GP60, which is the albumin receptor, which, will bind albumin in combination with caveolin 1, will form these little caveoli that are actively transported through the endothelial cells into the tumor bed. It's a very elegant experiment. And then we have the SPARC story. And SPARC seems to be kind of an albumin-binding sink. So
Hold on. The albumin receptor, is that cytoplasmic?
It's cell surface, the GP60.
Okay,
so it's on
the cell surface.
Correct, on the endothelial cell in the tumor bed.
Transmembrane?
I'm not quite sure if it's transmembrane, but it's important. And when you look at the experiments we're done, you see these very nice electron micrographs of, albumin binding and forming these little vesicles that are transported across the endothelial cell.
Endothelium, and that allows in the chemo into the tumor cells?
Well, yeah. So the preclinical data has always shown with nab-paclitaxel that there's preferential accumulation of drug in the site of the tumor. And the understanding of that is this process of transcytosis coupled with the SPARC expression, and that tends so
SPARC's in the tumor, though, right?
SPARC is excreted by the tumor into the tumor milieu, if you will.
SPARC is excreted, so it's not inside the tumor cell?
It's both.
Both,
actually.
Huh.
So I've come around to thinking of it as tumors are actually albumin sponges. And this is probably the mechanism by which that occurs. And when you look at the preclinical data and animal data, there is increased accumulation of drug in tumors when it's bound to albumin. And there was some data at AACR, I can't remember if it was this year or last year, that was very intriguing. This was, we're all excited about nab-paclitaxel and gemcitabine in pancreatic cancer. And they showed that the penetration of gemcitabine into these tumors was enhanced in the presence of nab-paclitaxel, thinking that that along with this allows increased penetration of all chemotherapy things into the thing. And we're dealing with this thing that I don't understand called stromal collapse, that when you have this process of getting albumin into that area with a tumor and the spark is there, that it destroys kind of the tumor microenvironment, if you will. And again, this is a concept that I've only heard about recently. There are some publications on it. It was presented at AACR. But it may be an explanation for the observations in pancreatic cancer with nab-paclitaxel.
Well, and also Dan von Hoff presented the data that looked like it correlated spark levels with efficacy. Yeah. Do you buy into that?
Well, it makes sense to me. Do we have enough data that that's now gospel? I don't think so. And I think we need more data. I think we need more data on caveolin-1 expression in tumors, spark expression in tumors.
So you can measure caveolin-1?
Sure. Yeah, there are some papers.
Did you look at in your study?
No, but there are some papers published looking at lung cancer and correlating increased caveolin-1 expression with the worst prognosis. So it's definitely there. And so we have a lot to learn about this sort of thing.
This thing about tumors being an albumin sponge, is there any sort of survival benefit? Or why would they do that? Or why would that happen?
Well, you know, obviously albumin is the largest amount of protein we have in our body. Obviously, tumors need protein to grow, the amino acids and all that kind of stuff. And so to me, it's always made sense that the tumor would want an advantage to get nutrition for the tumor mass that we're thinking needs to grow. So, you know, having said that, when this study was being considered, and obviously this study was intended to expand the indication, you know, Abraxane was approved in breast, and lung was a logical extension to go into. My understanding of the arrangement that the company has with the FDA was that they were happy to have overall response rate as the endpoint, since this was a drug that was already approved in lung cancer, Taxol, and this was really a reformulation. The trial, even though that was the primary endpoint, the trial was also powered to look at progression-free survival, since we thought that docs would want to have a bit more than just response rate. So what we're reporting at ASCO is just the data on the primary endpoint, and it's met its primary endpoint. How the trial was designed was we assumed carboplatin would have the same response rate that it had on ECOG 1594, which was 17%. The relative benefit in response rate in the breast cancer experience was about a 40% benefit in overall response rate. And so in this trial, we designed the Abraxane arm to have a 40% increase. So you wanted to increase your response rate from 17 to 24%.
Although the lingering question in breast cancer that I guess hasn't been completely resolved, there was a randomized phase two, was how much of this was the schedule.
Exactly.
And your study does have a schedule difference.
Yes. Now, in lung cancer, we did a pretty robust phase two, and Dr. Balani did a phase three looking at carboplatin every 3 weeks versus weekly.
Right.
And neither one of those stories suggested that with Taxol that made a difference. Now, it is the one variable. Actually, we have two variables, the nab-paclitaxel in the albumin story, and then the schedule. And this actually, you can imagine years ago when there was a lot of argument back and forth about what schedule and dose should go forward, but we picked a winner because this is a positive trial. So,
can you talk more about the numbers and what the eligibility was?
Yeah, so the eligibility was relatively straightforward in terms of stage 3B to 4, PS 0 to 1, previously untreated. You could not have symptomatic neuropathy going into the trial was the only thing, and you couldn't have active brain metastases. Treated brain mets were allowed, although very few patients with brain mets got on this trial.
When were the patients accrued?
They were accrued from like 07 to 09.
So what about biologics, specifically Bev?
Actually, of the accrual, only 12% of the 1,052 patients were accrued in the United States. 68% or so of the patients were accrued in Russia and the Ukraine. So very similar to the breast cancer sites. In fact, I think many of the breast cancer sites that were used in the initial Abraxane study were the same sites that were used in this lung cancer study.
Although I'm not sure where Bev was in breast cancer at that point as opposed to lung where...
Yeah.
But the bottom line is the patients didn't get Bev.
No. And so, for instance, at our institution, this was a trial that almost all the patients that we put on it had squamous histology.
Hmm.
You know, they weren't eligible for Bev at the time.
So what about the numbers?
So the numbers are the response rate to carboplatin was, I can't remember if it was 25 or 26%. And the response rate to the Abraxane was 33%. It met its endpoint. The p-value is highly statistically significant only because there are 1,050 patients looking at the response rate endpoint. There was a relative 31% improvement in the response rate. We broke it down. We did not pre-specify the analysis by histology. If you remember, you know, 3-4 years ago, histology was less of an issue than it is today. So we looked at histology, and the interesting thing and the most important observation is in the squamous histology patients, where the response rate to carboplatin is 25%. The response rate to carboplatin is 41%. So there's a huge difference in the squamous population. And the numbers that I'm quoting you are all independent radiologic reviews. So the primary endpoint was response rate by an independent review of radiologists. So that's the data that we'll show at this meeting.
How about progression-free survival and survival?
No data yet. We expect that data in probably the fourth quarter of this year.
Side effects, toxicity?
Less sensory neuropathy, less neutropenia. There was a bit more anemia and thrombocytopenia with Abraxane compared to Taxol, but the major difference was, I think the rate of grade 3-4 neuropathy with the Taxol arm was 10%, with the Abraxane arm was 3%.
And that's been debated in breast cancer. I'm not sure we know the answer. Do you think that's real?
I think it's real, but the question is, you know, I think if you give Taxol on a weekly schedule,
right,
there's less neuropathy. So the question is, how much of it is Abraxane,
right,
how much of it is the schedule?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mean real in terms of your study, but real in terms of clinically meaningful.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's clinically meaningful if you have it. If you can have, you know, 1 in 10 patients that get severe neuropathy versus, you know, 1 in 30 patients, it would be a better thing. And I think, you know, although I think neuropathy is hard to measure, you know, the sense is that perhaps it is more recoverable in the Abraxane experience than it is in the paclitaxel.
Do you have any sense specifically in patients with lung cancer about side effects and toxicity, let's say similar schedules, paclitaxel and NAB, in terms of your own experience or your guesses about tolerability?
Yeah, you know,
I guess the two things I guess would be most interesting is one, neuropathy, as you mentioned.
Right.
But I guess the other question, you hear so much debate about this, and again, is there a difference in breast and lung in terms of steroid issues?
Yeah, I was going to bring up the pre-medication issue. On the study, the patients in the Abraxane arm did not get any pre-medication, where on the Taxol arm, they got the standard pre-medication. The other issue is that the Taxol is given over 3 hours. The Abraxane is a 30-minute infusion, which you still have the chair experience, but you're not there for half the day. So I think those are an advantage. There were no hypersensitivity reactions on the Abraxane arm without medications. And, you know, we all deal with the patient that forgets to take them or doesn't want to take them because they don't like steroids. And, you know, we always, it seems like twice a month, my clinic is interrupted by a taxane infusion reaction. We have to stop it and medicate them again and either have them come back the next day or it delays them by 2 hours. And you just don't have that with Abraxane. So I think that that's a real advantage in terms of the convenience of administration.
So is it your take that as we move forward in time, it's going to play out that it's going to be more efficacious?
That is my sense. I am optimistic that this whole biology of albumin binding and all that stuff we talked about earlier is real. And so I think this is a more biologically potent way to administer a drug that has activity in breast, in lung, in ovarian, other tumors. It seems to be active in pancreatic cancer. So manipulating the biology of the tumor makes sense. So I think this is a step forward in the right patient. Now it may be that we will identify, you know, the issue about SPARC, the issue about GP60 or caveolin-1. I mean, those are going to require some well-designed prospective tissue-based studies to kind of identify patients who get benefit.
What's your current approach in terms of use of nab-paclitaxel outside a protocol setting?
I've used very little of it outside the protocol setting. We did some phase 1 studies years ago, phase 2 studies, and then we participated in the phase 3. So all of my use has been in the context of a clinical trial. However, I will tell you that this week I saw a patient with stage 4 squamous cell cancer, and I thought about, given the data that we'll show in the squamous population, that this guy, I felt like this was the kind of guy that needed a response with less toxicity. I'd be happy to tell you the details of the case, but this was a gentleman who in 1996 had a squamous cell carcinoma at the base of his tongue. And he had had surgery and radiation, and he had had, I think, 14 procedures because his course was complicated by osteoradionecrosis of the mandible. And he had 14 corrective and prosthetic sorts of things done over the years. Then he develops a big pleural effusion, big mass, a squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. This guy can't swallow. He's totally G-tube dependent. And he says, you know, if I have any nausea and vomiting, I'm going to aspirate and, you know, all these sorts of things. So I was trying to figure out, you know, what's the least toxic regimen, the most efficacious regimen. And, of course, the difference in response rate in the squamous population, 25 or 26% versus 41%, I was swayed by. I ended up not doing it in treating him with carboplatin and gemcitabine, but it certainly crossed my mind.
You know, it's interesting. We've polled physicians, both investigators and docs in practice, about NAB and breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, what do you think the efficacy is compared to paclitaxel? And they go, well, we do this quantitatively. They say, well, yeah, I think it's probably more effective. Not mm-hmm. sure, but probably. What do you think about the whole tolerability profile from, you know, the infusions, steroids, and neuropathy? I think it's, you know, they say, yeah, it's better tolerated. And then you say, well, what do you do? And then is where you see a lot of heterogeneity about whether people do it. And, of course, you say to them, suppose the costs were exactly the same, and everybody goes, oh, yeah, I'd never use paclitaxel.
Yeah. No, I think that that's true. I think that the cost is an issue with this agent. And, of course, the cost is only an issue because there's a generic
taxane.
You know, and if you look at the lung cancer world, Abraxane is no different in cost than Alimta or Avastin. I actually asked, you know, Hai Mus at our institution, I had this discussion with him about why doesn't everyone use Abraxane in breast cancer? And he said, in his opinion, it came down to cost. He goes, I think it's a better drug, but I don't think the cost differential I can justify.
What do we know about NAB with bevacizumab?
There's a trial, Craig Reynolds with the U.S. Oncology Group just recently published a large phase 2 trial, carboplatinum Abraxane every 3 weeks with bevacizumab. It was well tolerated. I can't quote you off the top of my head the response rate and outcomes, but it was pretty favorable. I mean, it was very good, actually. It was published in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology. And actually, you know, in thinking about this, based upon that phase 2 trial and everything we know about carbotaxol in Bev and everything we know about carboabraxane, I personally would not hesitate to use it. There is phase 2 data that I think I consider positive phase 2 data, even though it's not comparative. There is no phase 3 data. But remember, Abraxane, in my opinion, is a better way to give Taxol, which we're all giving for many of our patients.
We were talking earlier about the stage 3 setting, talking about carbopaclitaxel. What do we know about NAB there?
Yeah.
And what do we know about the interface between radiation therapy and NAB versus paclitaxel, radiation recall even, skin toxicity?
Right. I think there's been relatively little study of NAB paclitaxel with radiotherapy. I think it should be done. I think we know that paclitaxel is a great radiation sensitizer. NAB has been looked at. It possesses the same ability. If you could get better penetration of the Taxol, which is a sensitizer, in the tumor that's getting radiated, it makes sense that local regional control might be enhanced by getting more drug to the tumor. And you go back to the same biology we talked about before. It should be true in stage 3 disease as it is in stage 4.
What other research is being done, considered, would you like to see done? Obviously, the translational issues with NAB are really interesting.
Yeah, to me, the most important thing is finding out the biologic questions. You know, could you predict? Because I think we're in an era of more personalized medicine, if you will. But at least in lung cancer, outside of the few mutations and translocations that we have described, it's not too personalized right now. But we have a lot of options. We have a lot of options to treat the patients. You know, in the first line, I don't want to list all the options from a chemotherapy point of view. But if you could identify, you know, which patients, you know, I'm just as interested in that as I am in ERCC1, as in RRM1, as in TS, in, you know, Caveolin 1 and Spark would fall into that category of the same sorts of things. To me, if you have have a more active drug that's better tolerated, it makes sense to look at the up-and-coming targeted therapies being integrated. Historically, the VEGF TKIs have been difficult to integrate with chemotherapy because of the toxicities. Maybe this would be a better way, you know, to do it. Other targeted approaches. Can we manipulate this biology that seems to be, you know, very interesting in pancreatic cancer? In the phase 3 in the pancreatic cancer, the GEM versus Abraxane GEM is ongoing, and that will be a very interesting study.
Anything else that you want to comment on? Anything that you're looking forward to seeing here at this meeting that you think is going to be important for docs in practice to know about?
Well, I mean, I think the one important thing, we are presenting the CLGB trial in never smokers. And I think that as enthusiastic as we were about the IPASS data, I think the average community oncologist in the U.S. was wondering, well, in a study done in an Asian population, does that apply to my population? The CLGB data was mostly Caucasian U.S. patients, and pretty much that data mirrors the IPASS experience. Now, in IPASS, the rate of EGFR mutation was 60%. In the CLGB study, the rate of EGFR mutation was 40%. So not as high, but when you have a molecular finding that predicts for very high response and survival rates in 40% of your patients, you want to look for that. And so I think that this is going to reinforce the concept that we should be thinking about who we're going to get a mutation study on. And do we have enough tissue, and do we need to rebiopsy, and all those sorts of issues that come up in these patients? Because I do think the impact of a once-a-day oral drug can be fantastic in the right patient.
What about in the, let's say, previous smoker or even current smoker?
So yeah.
What's the incidence mutation there?
It's inversely related to your smoking exposure or how long ago you quit. So I think we're all struggling with who do you test. And I think, but you know, there are some people who say, well, everybody should be tested regardless. And I don't know if that's the right answer. In my practice, I test people who have non-squamous histology and who have 40 pack year or less. Now, am I going to miss a few EGFR mutations? Probably. But, you know, you have to kind of pick and choose. You got to establish some criteria. So that's what I do.
Although I'm not sure you do. And I think I know oncologists driving on the roads of America are thinking about their breast cancer patients where everybody gets HER2
right.
in ER,
right.
their colon cancer patients, everybody gets KRAS.
And it may be that everyone with non-squamous, regardless of this. Now, you can make the argument, how confident are you always that you know the difference between squamous and non-squamous? Another
yeah.
issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And maybe the right
issue.
Yeah. Maybe the right answer is to test everybody. But,
well, the downside is, you know, I guess cost, really.
Yeah, but,
it.
You know, but...
Maybe rebiopsy if you're really... you're not going to rebiopsy somebody with squamous cell, though.
I wouldn't.
But if you have the tissue...
If you have the tissue, if you've got a supraclave node that was resected, you got plenty of tissue, and you had these keratin pearls and, you know, and a guy who has a 60-pack year, what's the likelihood of finding an EGFR mutation is low. You know, what you could... Some people advocate... Start with KRAS if they are KRAS mutant. Of course, KRAS is less common than squamous. But if they have a KRAS mutation, they're probably not going to have an EGFR or an EML4 translocation. But we don't do that. I still think the role of KRAS testing in lung cancer is uncertain.